This is the Knowledge Bandits Podcast, and I'm your host, Arun Galadima. Let's start the show.
This is the Knowledge Bandits Podcast. I'm excited to bring you today's guest, Ms. Simi Fajemi-Roku. She's the founder of Read to Succeed Africa, a nonprofit organization that is committed to improving the state of public schools nationwide by using African design thinking to build inspired learning communities. Simi, I've given a very, very, very brief introduction, but can you please take the time to let the bandits get to know you a little bit better?
Okay, hi. Thank you for having me. And Read to Succeed Africa was founded officially 2 years ago, but we've been working in public schools, you know, since 2012. And it started out as a reading club just to boost the reading culture amongst primary school students in public schools. And then when we got in, we realized that, you know, 50% of the kids in primary six could not read or write. It was a travesty and extremely heartbreaking because we had to take a lot of our books back home with us because we went with a truck of books. We wanted to fix up the library and do all these wonderful ideas, and then we were stopped right in the middle when you realize that half of your target audience can't even read or write. Now, I did go to school in Nigeria. I finished primary six. And I did 1 year in Surulere. I did 1 year of secondary school in Vivian Fowler, also in Surulere. So I know, I know what I was reading at primary six in Nigeria in the same education system, two decades plus ago. So it was heartbreaking because I knew that I couldn't have a foreign, perspective on, maybe this is just what, poor African kids, this is the standard. No, because I know the standard when I was growing up, and I didn't go to any fancy private schools. So it was just not acceptable. So this passion took us to take it from a CSR initiative and just go full force. It was a CSR initiative of our consulting firm, Esfaj and Partners, which focus on research and development. And it just consumed me to the point where I just had to take it full time about 2 years ago. And we've been doing that ever since, adopting schools, transforming them, using African design thinking, and delivering programs that impact both the teachers, the students, and transform the environment. And our goal is pretty much to help create a coalition between the private sector and government to drive the process of transforming public education to what it should be in the 21st century within the next decade. And that's our goal.
Nice. Wow. A lot of different things. There's definitely a great start. You mentioned the term African design thinking. Can you unpack that a little bit?
Yeah, sure. Okay. So I'll just show an example. When you are when you take a picture of a school in Asia or in China somewhere, even if you didn't see the Chinese flag and even if you didn't see a Chinese person standing outside the school, something will let you know that this is a school in Asia somewhere in China. Same way with European schools, same way with even schools in America. But in African schools and Nigerian schools, there's really no distinction. And what you have as a distinction is just dilapidated classrooms, leaking roofs, broken chairs, not enough chairs, students sitting on the floor. But you don't really, even in the private schools, which are supposed to be the best, you walk in there and it's like they're almost trying to be, for you to be the best, you have to be Western, So we're challenging that and saying, look, Africanism, if I can use that term, and modernism are not mutually exclusive. We can be educated using cultural elements that reflect our values, that reflect our culture, and that can boost our pride. So, for instance, when we say African design thinking, so using design thinking, we go into a classroom, we observe for a week how the learning experience and how teaching is currently being delivered. And then when we interview teachers, we interview students, non-teaching staff, and before we even get to work. So that's what design thinking is basically creating using a user-centered model, almost like what you have in, you know, in the tech space, where you want to build an app, but you focus on the user, the end user, really. Because what you find is, even when you find people come in and renovate classrooms, when the private sector wants to renovate a classroom, just come in and splash paint and buy new desks and tables and then run off, you know, and it's like, what have you actually done? But when we go in, when we say design thinking, we actually, you know, use a lot of research and development and, you know, have a user-centered approach, one, to implement, you know, when transforming it, our culture. So, for instance, why does this matter? In one of our classrooms that we transformed using African design thinking, the first thing we noticed was the security guard, the gatesman of the school. He wanted automatically to learn in that classroom, even if you wanted to teach him German. And the question was, after we transformed the classroom, and question was why? Because when on the one of the walls, the abstract art we used northern, because the school is based in Abuja, so we used northern dinner mats called pai pai as abstract art on one section of the classroom wall, and because so the gatesman said, oh, you know, he told our team, he was like, ah, he wants to learn in this classroom, or he wants to be a student in this classroom. And we asked him why. He said, because the things on the wall is what his mother, it was what his brothers do in Maiduguri. So he, because he felt connected to the classroom, you could even teach someone who never thought of learning or even going to school or even, you know, being literate. So it shows the connection between, you know, when there's a sense of identity, a sense of identity creates a sense of belonging. And then you don't have to preach to people to send their children to school. It would just be automatic because they see a sense of themselves in schools, especially in areas where there are cultural issues with going to school. You know, so if you just put a little bit of culture in the school, you'll see that it's just automatic for people to want their children to go to school. And children also tended to stay back in classroom when the bell rang instead of running out. You know, so these are things that we've noticed because, again, they see themselves in the classroom.
Interesting. So one thing that you mentioned is growing up in Nigeria, going to the school, you understood how the system was, and that was in the back of your mind and prompted you to make a change. But as you were growing up, was this something that was always in your mind, or did you sort of rekindle that passion later on in life?
Well, mom is an educationist. She studied education, and she either worked as a teacher, even when we moved abroad. So she was always in the education space. So I guess it wasn't too far from me. I don't know if I personally thought I was going to grow up and be in the education space, but my mom was, her dream was to own a school, and so I think in the back of my mind, my idea of one day, you know, showing my mom how much we appreciate it was to build her a school. So yeah, so maybe it's beyond me a little bit, but apart from that, everywhere I've been, like whether I schooled or lived in, such as in the UK or the US, I've always found myself in either youth development center teaching or helping kids through their SATs or helping in the youth church. So I've always been in this space of, you know, constantly teaching, really informally, of course. So it just came, you know, natural, like, okay, we're running a business and we were focused on, I really, really, really believe that we are a generation that can't afford to just do business alone. Because there's so much work to be done to fix our communities, we kind of have to do both at the same time. So I'm a firm believer. I don't even consider it giving back. I don't know what giving back means. And personally, I don't know how much Nigeria has given me that I've given back. But I honestly think we're just a generation. I think it's a privilege, you know, on like the generation before us, where, you know, they could just, you know, stick to the private sector, and, you know, be billionaires or multimillionaires. I think we have to do both. We both have to create a hybrid of some sort between the private sector and community service. Because at the end of the day, no matter how successful we are in our individual businesses in Nigeria, if we're not concerned about the ecosystem around it, we would eventually be endangered species. So it just came natural. Like, okay, what do we do? And then where could we get the most impact? And where's the least popular or the least sexy, you know, because people want to do sexy initiatives and education is just not one of those, you know, sexes. Education. People just pretty much roll their eyes. You know, people want to, you know, raise money for a disease or, you know, brave the shade. You know, so they want to be part of things, you know, very intervention things. Who's really focused on institutionalizing change? And this is where it comes from, is education. You make the most impact. Public education, there's no one institution in the country that impacts the Nigerian life the most than education. It's the only one institution that holds at least the Nigerian child at least for 18 years. And that's three phases. You know, so, I mean, yes, it's not sexy, but it's the most impactful.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah, I could not agree more. Yeah, I usually take about a 2 or so mile walk every day. And on my walk yesterday, it's funny that you said what you said. On my walk yesterday, I was thinking about the way businesses are structured, and it sparked a conversation I had about a year and a half ago with one of my friends. But I was thinking, in my business 101 class, one of the first things you learn is who the stakeholders are in your business. And you go, yeah, shareholders, customers, employees, but the community is also a stakeholder in your business. I think oftentimes businesses forget that. It's one of those pieces of information that's a good to know, but when you go into the real world, it's not implemented, but the community is your stakeholder just as well as the customer is. And I think oftentimes people lose that. And that's kind of what has created a convoluted business system that we operate in currently. But I like what you're saying about how businesses need to be socially responsible. It just needs to be part of it. It's not giving back, but it's a duty of the business to do this.
Absolutely.
Yeah. But as we go a little bit further, what's your background? Like, how did you find yourself starting Read to Succeed?
Okay, my background, education-wise, you mean?
Sure, education-wise, and what you were doing for work before actually getting into Read to Succeed.
Okay. My education background is politics and international relations. And by nature, I'm a political animal. What work I was doing before we started a consulting firm when I moved back to Nigeria. Well, I did my NYSC first. And before that, I had worked for about 6-7 years, in the pharmaceutical space, in Columbia, Maryland, then decided to move back, did my NYSC for 1 year, served in a communication, medium-sized communication firm in Abuja. And right after service ended, started, you know, a company called Estrogen Partners that was based on research and development and building up data, as you know, management consulting and building up data primarily for government, because a lot of our record and data is based on is kind of outdated. So the company was set up primarily to provide up-to-date data. And then, so doing that for a couple of years, and then you always starting Read to Succeed Africa as a CSR project. And like I said earlier, it took its own course as we figured that there were just more issues than boosting the reading culture, which was the whole idea that we set out to do in the first place. And, you know, my background in social, in terms of community service, whether in the States, like I said, whether in the UK, I've always, you know, served in the youth space, either providing college prep or just youth church activities where, you know, the arts, and because I love music as well. So you know, started a youth choir. So I've always been in that space of constantly building up people's talents and potential as well as serving in the youth church. So, yeah, this came natural to me to walk into classrooms and read to kids and, you know, make reading fun. Of course, if you know the typical Nigerian classroom is not a lot of fun, you know, you're either being beaten or threatened and a lot of things. So we were like that, those team of people that come in every Thursday because the R2S class, we just picked Thursday and they just couldn't wait. They couldn't wait to have us. I mean, from the gate, you could hear the kids screaming and jumping. So it was great. It was great to make fun. And it was also more important to see kids that had been neglected in the class take an interest in reading, because the classroom sizes are so large. You know, they're about, 60, 70 classroom people, students in the classroom. And what that does is that only if they, so basically 20% of kids are learning, that's who the teacher focuses on. But by the end of the our first year, you know, I remember the head teacher said to us, why are we bringing complex poems to class? Because our first poem was Invictus, and we would teach on African history and African leaders such as Mandela, which these kids didn't know anything about. So it was very scary, you know. So we just thought, oh, let's just talk about Mandela today. And then who knows Mandela, and the whole classroom would just look like blank at you. And you're like, oh, wow. So we're not teaching history in classes. And then, you know, it just, again, so we focus on African history, leadership, and poems. So we would teach Invictus. And, you know, the head teacher came to tell us, why are we teaching these complex poems? You know, these kids don't know anything. And then she was surprised at the end of the year when the kids were saying, reciting Invictus, you know, I am the cat, I can't even remember the poem, and I'm the teacher, but they were reciting the poem by heart, you know, at their graduation classes. So it reinforced that, okay, we needed to do more of these things. Education was failing our students, and how can we run this as an intervention to improve the lot of, you know, these kids in public schools who are largely neglected, really, by the system, by politicians, private sector at large.
I mean, it's kind of ironic that an educator would say that the kids don't know anything, because that's kind of on you, but that's another discussion. You mentioned NYSC, but there's so many things you said that I want to touch on. But for those people that are listening that aren't familiar with NYSC, can you give a brief overview?
Oh, okay. National Youth Service Corps. I'm trying. Okay. I'm going to sound really serious, but really, I wasn't sure what I wanted to do when I moved back. So I just used it as a platform to just stay in the country for a year without anyone asking me what I was doing with my life. So I also knew that it was, you know, it would be necessary at some point when, if you ever wanted to be involved in public service or government, governance, whatever. So, I knew it was not just a nice to have for me, who always wanted to be in government or support government efforts or initiatives to serve people better. I knew that NYC, I needed it. So I came in, and in December 2010, but I didn't get to serve until the first batch in middle batch, batch B. In, there are three batches a year, by the way. And you can, in March, May, and I think the last one is in November. And it's a year's program where you basically do 3 weeks orientation, and you serve in a school or where in a public institution somewhere where they assign you for a year. So it's a way, it was created pretty much for people to serve their country for 1 year before entering into the workforce fully. It was also used after the Civil War to push integration. So if you're in Lagos, you'll be posted to Yobe. If you're in Yobe, you'll be posted to Enugu. So the whole idea was, so the more people worked and served in different parts of the country, promote unity and understanding and all of that.
And did you feel like you still got that sort of experience that was intended while you did it? Or what was the net benefit?
honestly, yes and no. Yes, because again, if you've not been in the country since elementary school or primary school, and it provides you with an immediate network, to be honest. So I remember that I was at camp, and you know, sometimes I would even lie like, oh yeah, I went to Uni Ben or Uni Joe, so I would just make just a thing. So it was a great melting pot from people from all over the country, different universities, different backgrounds. And it was, you know, it's a nice crash course if you're moving back, you know, into the country, and you leave with a network of people and friends that I have till this day, really. So it's huge. I would say it's a big plus. I would say no, because a lot of the processes are inefficient and it can be very frustrating. So if you're coming from a system oriented space, and you come in and you don't understand why you have to stay in long lines, or you don't understand the application process where they're asking you for your secondary school certificate, and I'm like, if nowhere in the world, once you have your degree, no one asks you for your social your secondary stuff. So yeah, some of the processes are inefficient and can be quite, you know, frankly annoying, but it overall, so it can be improved. But overall, it's an amazing experience, and I'm happy I did it.
And see, I get that from most people who've gone back to Nigeria, whether it's just after being in university or being gone for a long period of time. They say it helps them integrate with the system, interact with people, and sort of make friends while you're in Nigeria, because a lot of the people you knew before are probably not there, or you might not even have any things in common later on. But I usually hear exactly what you're saying, both mixed, both positive and sort of critical criticisms of it. So moving forward, what, in your mind, what is your vision for education in Nigeria and across Africa?
Oh, that's easy. It's just scary, but it's easy. To make our public education system so good that, you know, we depopulate private schools in Nigeria. So, and we've seen it in Rwanda, for instance. In 10 years, Rwanda had a problem. Their private schools had a problem of, you know, where they're being depopulated to a point where a lot of them were closing businesses because the education system, the public education system, was that good. And why does this matter? Because the system that we have right now is just unsustainable. To have an elite-based system where even from nursery and primary school, some of these private schools are charging millions per term. That is ridiculous. If you look at the recent ads by banks, whether it's First Bank or all the other banks, I mean, they're offering school loans, and you think that it's for university or something, but it's for primary school loans and secondary school loans to parents. That's madness. So how do you save up for your child's, you know, higher education when you're spending so much just to educate them, you know, in a private school system? So it's actually not sustainable, and it became more unsustainable when we had issues with the economy, when we had a recession. We're still just inking out of it, but we're still feeling the heat of a recession. And it's not sustainable to have, if you have two kids, and you have them in a private system, how do you survive when each per term or per year you pay 1.5 million? You know, so we're already seeing the recession for us was a good thing in for education, because then people started to actually think, we can't sustain this, you know. And people were beginning to send their children to, you know, public schools a little bit. You know, you are seeing a little bit of, people sending them. But we don't want it to be because you can't afford private schools. We want it to be because public schools is just that much better. And there's no greater reflection of a great Nigeria than its education system. There's none. If your education system is terrible, then it shows the state of the country in itself. I don't care what the economic indices are saying. You know, if your largest natural resource, which is your human population, if majority of that population is being undereducated or uneducated, Nigeria has a huge problem on its hands. So that's our vision. Our vision is to make our public school system so good, like it was, you know, in the 80s, where you heard of CMA grammar school, where you heard of the different grammar schools, and you knew that these are the current crop of, you know, multimillionaires or billionaires or top 50 businessmen went to these public schools. Mm-hmm. None of them went to private schools. In fact, it was frowned upon. You were like a sissy or something if you went to a private school. It's like, oh, you know, you probably couldn't have the public school, you know, the test and the rigor and the thoroughness. That's why your parents sent you to a private. It was frowned upon. Mm-hmm. The same way it's frowned upon in countries like in East Africa, in Kenya, for instance. If you're in a private school, they look at you like you must be a dummy. Mm-hmm. You know, so it's, we need to get back. I don't believe in getting back, sorry. We need to advance and move forward and know that, look, Nigeria's largest, you know, and greatest resource, natural resource, are its people. Mm. And how well educated they are, it will determine not only its future workforce, but its development at large.
Mm. Yeah. And I'm sure you're working in the public sector, and really wherever you go in the world, the public sector is pretty difficult to change. And what you guys are trying to do is, I think it's quite large scale. And if you haven't already, I'm sure you'll receive any pushback, but I just want to get from you. Have you sort of felt that sort of pushback as you've tried to change the way people are educated in Nigeria?
Yes, we do. First of all, I think the greatest pushback that you find is, it's not even a pushback per se. In of itself, is apathy. Mm. You know, you walk into the State Board of Education and they're just weary and overwhelmed, and they're like, okay, yeah, so what do you want? Yeah. All right, whatever. I mean, they actually don't care. Like, I think that's the worst feeling. I think I'd rather have love, hate, but then to have just indifference is just very difficult to work with. If I was working with hate, I would say, okay, let me transform your hate to love, you know. Or if I was working with love, then I could say, how can I take your limitedness, but you want to change this thing, but you're just limited maybe in terms of resources or capacity, but how can we support you to move forward? But what you just have is apathy. I mean, people just clock in time and just like, yeah, it's 4 p.m. They're selling puff in the hallways, selling materials. You know, they're holding either services, you know, either Muslim or Christian services. In you know, in the boardrooms and in the offices, and you're like, okay, we're doing everything but what we're supposed to do as a government, which is solve the challenges that we have in education. Sometimes you see like there are some symposiums or conferences around education. In the past decade, 12 states have declared state of emergency in the education space. But it's just always half-hearted. You know, they form a committee, but nothing really happens. I think the first state you've probably seen move the ball and take bold, arduous decisions is probably Kaduna State, where they threatened to sack over 20,000 teachers that could not pass a primary four-level test. You know, and those are the things that government's not willing to do. They're not willing to take the bull by the horns and make hard decisions and say, look, if we need to fire 60% of the workforce because it's just not up to par and hire again, they're not willing to take those political risks because, you know, the politicians are looking at the next election, and civil servants have always been a mainstay. So, you know, no one really wants to upset the status quo. But what is happening in Kaduna is what we really need to see across board. I mean, a purge really of the system and getting new blood in, and, you know, and yeah, we just need that kind of bold move in the education space to shake it up. Otherwise, what we get is just apathy. And rightly so, because they're also overwhelmed. Nigeria is supposed to spend, at least according to the UN, UNDP, we're supposed to spend about between 15-20% of our budget on education. We roughly spend between 7-8%. So it's underfunded. So based on that, you know, because they just feel like they can't do anything to solve it, so why don't we just, you know, not do anything at all? So just show up in offices, while away time, make sure you get your pay and be out.
Yeah, I definitely agree with you that apathy is the hardest thing to change. It's so, I mean, with dealing with that apathy, how do you work on, I guess, changing people's mind for the future? And this is across the board, across Africa, because I'm sure that a lot of the things that are happening in Nigeria are what's happening across Africa. So how do you change that apathy? And for people within the country and outside of the country, how do they get involved and press for change?
Okay. The first part of your question is how do we change? Honestly, there's a quote that I like. It's anytime the majority of people behave a particular way, majority of the time, the people are not the problem. And I think once that quote, once I started to digest that quote more and more, I stopped taking it personal. Because before, you know, you would literally go back to the office in tears and frustration. And how don't these people care? How don't these people know what is at risk? How we're destroying generations and how we're, you know, how we're pretty much aborting our future. You know, how don't they understand the gravity of the issues, you know, and you just be so angry. And then you just realize that, you know what, it's not that permanent secretary, it's not that secretary, it's not the executive chairman of the board, it's not the minister of education, it's a systemic problem. So whatever you push at me, I've just stopped taking it personal. And, you know, and if you understand that, hope in itself is audacity. You know, there's audacity to look at darkness and dare to see light somewhere, you know, and say, look, you know, if we've, so there's a lot of self-talk, like literally, you know, Monday morning meetings, half the time, we're not even talking strategy. We're just pretty much building ourselves up. I mean, we're self-talking all the time. I mean, we get together as a team and we're like, okay, remember our icebreakers such as, show me your, give me your greatest hits track record. And you're like, okay, greatest hits track record was when, you know, I scored the goal on my team, or when I learned how to ride a bicycle. And we have to do these things and go deep within when we face main challenges as individuals and how we overcame that. And we have to do that and say, okay, so the same is required of us at this stage of our lives. So let's keep going. And that really, really helps us to, first of all, look within and say, look, when were moments where you challenge the status quo and you won? And you find, even no matter how simple or basic or inconsequential or mundane, I mean, we take those things, we put them on vision boards, we record them and we listen to them over and over so that we can remind ourselves that we can do it again. You know, we can do it again. And this is just a different sector. It's a different thing, but we can do it again. And also the option of what happens if we do nothing. And, you know, and to be honest, I do see our generation as the one that builds, a rebuilder of some sort, you know, a Nehemiah generation that rebuilds the walls that have been broken. So when there's a sense of purpose, it helps you push through. It helps you beyond your feelings of, oh, you know, this is so crummy. I feel that when your ego is deflated and when you're feeling sad. And I just had that situation just last week, Friday. So it's you, every time you think you beat it, like, oh, last year, oh yeah, we went through our worst, lowest low. You get hit, you know, but with left jab again, and you're like, oh my God, like, you know. So one thing is government. When we started to engage private sector, their apathy was even worse. They're like, ugh, ew, public schools. How about we do programs in private schools, or how about we do programs at, you know, sports? And you're like, are you joking? Like, I never anticipated that it would be difficult to sell to the private sector the importance of supporting education. I thought it would be, oh, you know, we give you a nice CSR prepackaged thing that makes you show your shareholders what you've been doing in the community, and you get to develop the community that you work in. And they're like, no, you know, they want to do floozy things. You know, you're like, are you joking? So I think that was a huge setback. And it's, you know, so you set back from government and then private sector, and you're like, oh my God. So, but again, that self-talk is extremely important. I run a lot. I run by the lake. I run by water. I run on the bridge. So constantly like pushing your body hard, and it just helps you push mentally as well. And what people can do outside the country, support is our third phase that we also hope to go on tours in diaspora communities, and because they're huge, they're the highest form of direct investments in the country, or foreign inflow. So we don't think we can win this war against poor education without the diaspora. So I mean, we are putting programs in place, that will help us even share the awareness, amongst our diaspora communities. Because if you look at the way Israel was built as a country, it was built largely, even Asian countries, largely by the diaspora communities that were intentional about building their home countries. So Nigeria should be no exception. Data shows that already they are. It's just probably not harnessed in targeted areas, but they are. I mean, a lot of families are existing right now from, funds being sent from abroad, a son or daughter, someone that's sending money back. So already we are helping. The diaspora community is already helping. It just needs to probably be targeted.
Wow. I think one thing that can be said about you is that you're passionate. I can hear your passion throughout every word that you speak about this. So that's really great to hear. But you started getting into this a little bit, but we want to know about you as an entrepreneur a little bit more. So what fires you up in the morning? What's your morning routine, and why is that routine important to you?
What fires you up in the morning? Oh, Lord. How to kill enemies of progress.
So you listen to a lot of fella, that means.
Yes. Well, a lot of rap music, I've been doing something recent as well, because also I went back home, like to my home state, and I went, we have this thing called Oriki, so where it's basically your family lineage in a given, in a proverbial way that tells you of yourself, pretty much tells you how great you are. So I've added that to my routine. I'm like, okay, looking at my Oriki, I'm like, okay, yes, I'm great. Because that's important, because at least it shows the power, of course, of our culture, the power of generations, and the power of standing on giants from before us who tried as much as possible to push the bar. And what they were fighting at the time was completely different from what we're fighting now, whether it was colonialism or, raw military disruptions. And, we are fighting the aftermath of military disruptions and a military hangover. And how do we, push through, these things using technology, and I think the key, what fires me up is in the morning as well, is how much of myself do I give, and how much and where do I set the baseline? Where do I set the baseline of, how do I, it's Nigeria, Joe, So that means when you hear that statement, it means anything goes. And how do you stop that from seeping in into your psyche? Because it's when you hear that every day, at some point in time, you're just going to stop shooting for excellence. You're just going to start shooting for rubbish plus one at best. Because it's Nigeria. I'm like, no, actually, I don't care. We deserve, our people deserve the best. Our people deserve the best services. We deserve the best infrastructure. We deserve the best. And it's just not something you hear on a daily basis. So, yeah, that's what fires me up in the morning. It's just trying to provide distinctions and showing that, no, we do deserve the best. And no matter how many small pockets we have of different people in different sectors, showing that distinction that Nigerians deserve better and deserve the best. That fires me up in the morning. My routine, first thing is to pray. I don't know how anyone survives here without God, without prayer. I don't know. I mean, I'm just like, wow. If I ever thought I was a woman of faith before, and nothing compares to the faith you have to have every day to believe that today is going to be better than yesterday and tomorrow is going to be better than today. Because even when you're having a great day, the internet could just, you know, just shut you down. Lights, generator, diesel, the traffic, whatever, fuel scarcity. So you're not even focusing just challenges in trying to do what you do. You're facing challenges that are just in the atmosphere. You're like, and you're constantly in battle mode. So it keeps me grounded to wake up in the morning and just dedicate my day to God. And then run. I run because it just keeps me sane. And right after, I'm a poor eater. I wish to lie and say I have breakfast. I don't. But I do try and stay hydrated. So I take as much water as I can take, at least 3 liters a day of water, to stay hydrated. And I think that's about it. And I read my Bible.
Nice.
And listen to podcasts. I'm always on BBC Business Daily, always Harvard Business Review, and TD Jakes and Knowledge Bandits.
Okay.
So when you email, I actually knew about you guys.
Nice. That's good to know. That makes me happy. And so, being an entrepreneur, your passion, I'm sure your passion is what sustains you, but can you take us to a point where that passion didn't seem like it was enough to push you through that dark time? Just take us to one of those moments.
I remember my first first contract that we had, which was to provide research, to provide data on youth in agriculture. So we went to our select states and went to the ministries of agriculture. We got all the governor's approval that we needed, and, you know, we started work. And so this particular government official says, you know, why don't we just, he has a report already ready. Why don't I just give him my company logo and, you know, we could just submit the report as done and then we could just split the money. And we were like, no, that's not going to happen. We actually need to do the work. And I remember myself and my two colleagues, Tunde and Ishada, who were in the parking lot. I would just never forget this scene. And I said, you know, we have to do a movie. And my friend, my colleague Tunde actually recently wrote a book, you know, The Day the Madman Knew. It just captures some of these things in it. And we're in the parking lot of the Ministry of the State Ministry of Education of Agriculture, sorry. And we're on our knees, literally begging to work. It was just like, who does that? You know, like begging to do the work. And, you know, at some point in time, you know, it's just something you can't read that in a business book anywhere. You know, how do you fight to do work, to deliver? Like, not because the stakeholders and, you know, the typical things that you get. No, you just want to, you know, you from the person who's contracting you to do the work. And we got through that day. We got into the car and it was very humbling. I remember I was close to tears because I was like, what have I gotten myself into? What kind of country is this? Should I just run back where I can just work? What I'm complaining about is being paid for overtime or extra benefits or being promoted, but never, ever being challenged to not work. So went back to the hotel and debriefed and said, you know what? Come rain, come sunshine, we're delivering. If we have to, we found we have to, you know, go against the grain. And we did. You know, we went to the universities, we partnered with, we just found different ways. And it's just when you learn as a child, where there's a will, there's a way. When you grow up, you realize that it really is true. Where there's a will, there's a way. It doesn't matter how hard, you know, even when the system is against you, you can, once you're willing and you're like, you visualize the end. And all I saw was the end of a report that was to show, and which was an amazing report because the report went against the data in the states that showed that youth were not in agriculture. our report came back and said 70% of youth were in agriculture. The problem is they would never take employed. Farmers, youth farmers will always take unemployed on a farm. So they were like ghost workers on the farm. So because farming was not seen as a business, it was just seen as a culture, something that we do culturally, but you don't see it as a business. So visualizing the end and just see, you can't imagine all the multiplier effects this would have on policy, on, you know, on funding and changing how things are done. So just keep a picture. So I mean, I'm a very visual person anyway, and now I do as much whiteboards, and I have so many cardboards around our office space with different things on it, because you just constantly have to keep the end in mind, which is success, execution, results, impact, change. And you have to keep those things around you as much as possible, so that the inner will overcomes what you're facing externally.
Nice. I definitely appreciate you sharing that. I think it's always great to see how entrepreneurs are able to overcome these hard times. And it seems like you sort of had your eyes set on something, and that helped you push through. You also had a group of people around you, so you weren't in isolation when you were going through these situations. And I'm sure that helped as well.
Absolutely.
We definitely want to talk about the high. We don't want to end on the low. So what is one point? I'm sure there have been many, but what is one point that you can think of through starting your business in Nigeria that you felt like this is exactly where you needed to be?
There are many. But I'll just talk about recently, which was last month. Read to Succeed Africa got invited with winners of our vision board exercise across 5 schools to visit the vice president at the villa, at the presidential villa, which was basically a huge endorsement from the highest office in the land. Mm-hmm. And it was a high moment because we had told the students during the vision board exercise, because we basically went with cardboard and the trucks of magazines and glue and scissors, and we told kids, you know, imagine the future and design it. We taught them problem solving skills and goal setting and all of that. And I remember when we said, you know, dreams do come true. You know, what speak to you, you never know where it could go. Actually, a manifestation of what we had told the kids. And then, you know, and they, you know, taking them to a place that in their generation, they would never have imagined, you know, going, not just to see him, but to have their vision board signed individually by him, to have a chat with him for 45 minutes about how he designed his future and all of that. And I guess that was a huge, huge, it was so rewarding. It was really rewarding to take kids to the presidential video and see, and literally just an immediate example, just 2 weeks after they did a vision board exercise, or 4 weeks after they did it, to see them honored, you know, by the presidency was huge for us. So we're really got excited.
Nice. And I think with that, we're going to move on into the rapid fire round. Are you ready?
Yes, sir.
Cool. What was initially stopping you from taking the step to become an entrepreneur?
Money. Would you want me to expand?
If you'd like to.
No, actually not money. I just wasn't clear about what I wanted to do. I knew I couldn't keep working where I was working, and I knew I was satisfied, but I wasn't sure what it was that uncertainty, actually, because I'm not like a lot of talented people where you have one major thing that sticks out and you know, okay, yeah, this is what I'm supposed to do. I'm pretty much a little bit of everything in different places. So, you know, I sing, I write, so I'm pretty much a generalist. It was difficult to find an angle into entrepreneurship. So, yeah, that would be the most difficult step.
And when did you stop looking at your business as a project and more as an actual business?
When I got paid. When we got our first check, And it was just, I couldn't believe it. I was like, oh my. Someone actually paid us to do this? Wow.
Yeah. And what is your superpower as an entrepreneur?
Superpower as an entrepreneur is doggedness, I think. I just think, I don't consider myself very intelligent or very smart or anything, but I do consider myself someone that is addicted to results. So until we get results, we don't stop.
And what quality do you wish to improve on most as an entrepreneur?
Negotiations. I think I suck at negotiations. I get on the table and I'm almost waiting for people to hand me something. You know, I wish I was more like, more assertive, more like, this is what we are going to do. You know, I'm kind of like always hoping that someone, they're nice to me. I like the business world is not nice. Everyone is there for their interests. So, yeah, I wish I was more, animalistic or something. But yeah.
And what's the best advice you've received and who is it from?
Best advice. But I think from my, I was doing a fundraise for a startup, a legal startup, tech startup. It was my first run in the tech space. And he was like, instead of seeing investors as investors, see them as, call it the user fund. So, recreate your pitch instead of, oh, hi, this is who I am, invest in what I'm doing. And so it's like, look, this is what you're going to use, and this is why you should be investing in it. So you not only get to use it, but then you also get to benefit from it, from, you know, dividends and returns. So that was probably one of, I've had lots of advice, but that was the most recent best advice I've received.
And what are you reading right now?
Right now, I am reading a book called Grit. Grit, and it's an amazing book, actually, that by a social scientist who pretty much studies passion and perseverance and why some people make it through and why some don't.
And what is one internet resource or application that you couldn't live without, excluding Google and some of those major ones?
We do a lot of presentations, so I would say Slidebean. Because we're constantly presenting our ideal pitching. So Slidebean has been a huge resource for us.
Nice. And to close out the rapid fire round, do you feel like you've made it yet?
Absolutely not. far from it, but it's been you're seeing yourself inch closer and closer and closer, and you know, each time you are getting clarity, and I think that is so priceless. It's so priceless because what you think you wanted to do until you actually do the work, it constantly evolves. It constantly evolves, and I think the tech world understands this better than, you know, other sectors. It's just that constant improvisation. So, yeah.
And as we cool down, what is one book that you would recommend to the bandits?
One book. Honestly, it would be this book I'm reading. Angela Duckworth, Grit. Because it's really helping me in a time I really need it the most. And I know the hardest part about entrepreneurship is really the uncertainty of if you're going to get paid for the work you're doing, when you're going to get paid, when, you know, if you're going to be able to build a team that's loyal, that is productive, that actually works, and sees the vision more than you, and are just not biding time and just trying to get paid. I think it's just a reminder that grit is a muscle you need to develop. It's not, you know, and even if you thought you had it, you need to actually be intentional. So there's a part of the book that says practice versus deliberate practice. So you and I could have 20 years in our careers, but you could have 20 years in your career, or I could have 1 year experience 20 times. So it's, you know, and understanding that there is a distinction. So if you're not intentional, if you're not deliberate, I mean, you could be putting in a lot of hard work and still not ending up where you want to be. So I would recommend this book, really.
Nice. And what advice would you give to some of the people listening who are afraid to take that step into entrepreneurship?
I'm just going to be very lame here and say something cheesy like, just do it. But I have analysis paralysis. I could give you 1,000 excuses just to do one thing. But I've constantly challenged myself, you know, to even when I'm running, take a new route, push myself to send that email, to send that text, send that WhatsApp message to that person that I'm so afraid of, that because I'm scared if they, what if they don't respond? What if they don't like me? What if they don't buy into the idea? Send it anyway. You know, even if you have to say, you know, John Mayer has a song, you know, say, and I, in the part of the song that I pretty much remind myself, like, even if you're shaking like a leaf, you know, say it anyway. You know, say, do it anyway. Do it afraid. You know, do it afraid. Because the fear is normal. And I think embracing the fact that fear is normal, because it's uncomfortable, it's challenging. You know, you want to know all your answers. You want your graph to look like a certain way and see your plot and see, but you know what? Do it afraid. I think that would be my advice. I hope that helps.
Nice. And unfortunately, we're reaching that time where we have to say goodbye. So can you let the bandits know how they can connect with you, whether it's through email, Twitter, your website, Facebook, all of that stuff?
Okay, fantastic. Dear bandits, you can reach out to us at we're Twitter and Instagram. Our address is the same on both, at R2S_Africa. And you see some of the work that we're doing. Not only that, we're pushing a lot of things that are just challenging the status quo. And it would be great to get your support. And also, you learn a lot, you know, about, because we're pushing a lot of data out there as well, and things that we hope that inspire you. Oh, the website is r2safrica.org. r2safrica.org. So, yeah, you could catch our blog there. And I think that's it.
Nice. And for all those bandits that are listening right now, if you go to Simi's page on the Knowledge Bandits website, all of that information will be available, along with the books that she recommended. Well, Simi, it's been an amazing opportunity to be able to speak with you. The work you're doing is amazing. I've appreciated our time, and I'm sure the bandits have appreciated it as well.
Thank you so much for having me. And I want to just recommend you and your team. You guys, just again, we don't have enough of these things. What you guys are doing is amazing. There's only so much of HBR I can take, and telling me examples in the U.S. When I hear from my own people, it makes a difference. So I should thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. I always say I get to talk to people, talk to really interesting people, and the least I can do is record it and share it. Yeah. Well, stay inspired.
Hey, if you're still there, thanks for listening. If you like the show, please hit that subscribe button wherever you listen to podcasts, and follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Handle is Knowledge Bandits everywhere. We have closed sessions lined up with some of the entrepreneurs that we've already interviewed. So if you have questions that weren't answered during the show, you'll have a chance to connect with them during these closed sessions. Just go to the Knowledge Bandits website at knowledgebandits.com and sign up for the newsletter on the contact page. If you or someone you know has a business, we'd love to share your story with the Knowledge Bandits community. Just send an email to interview@knowledgebandits.com. If you have a question for me, or you want to connect with any of the guests so far, send an email to me personally at arum@knowledgebandits.com. Finally, if you love music and you have a few moments, please listen to Slim Freedom's cover of Landslide.
Within my heart, rise above. Can I Can the child within my heart rise above? Can I sail through the changing ocean tide? Can I handle the seasons of my love.